negative ones, because apparently everybody is entitled to an opinion, even the ignorant and foul-mouthed. Jack arrives home after 9. By then I'm asleep on the sofa. He bends and kisses me on the forehead. "Sorry," I say, reaching up and kissing him properly. He helps me stand. I pour him a glass of wine. "How was your day?" "Great. The best." He sits at the kitchen table, looking pleased with himself. "Do I have to guess?" "I'll tell you over dinner." He can't wait that long, and tells me as I'm dressing the salad. "I pitched the idea for the new show today. They love it. Bailey, Turnbull, the whole team got excited. They're going to put it in the schedule for the spring." "Are you going to host?" "I'm sure I'll get it. I mean, it was my idea." I feel a pang of concern, but I don't want to spoil Jack's mood. "When will you know?" "In the next 4 weeks." He nuzzles my neck and gives my bottom a squeeze. I playfully push him away and tell him to wash his hands. It's ages since I've heard him sound so upbeat. Maybe things are looking up. A new job, more money and a baby. There are so many ways to move forward, and only one way to stand still. Agatha. On Saturdays, Jack gets up early and goes for a run along the river. Afterwards, he takes the kids to a cafe in Barnes for baby chinos and muffins, meeting up with other dads who drink coffee, read newspapers, and ogle the au pairs and yummy mummies. Gales is the newest place to be seen in Barnes. On weekends, it's full of dads and their kids, and weekend road warriors dressed in lycra, who chain racing bikes to the railings while they fuel up for the ride home. This area of London is a leafy village trapped in a bend in the river between Putney and Chiswick. An oasis of calm, full of overpriced houses, boutique shops and cafes. The locals are mostly company directors, stockbrokers, diplomats, bankers, actors and sports stars. I saw Stanley Tucci walking across Barnes Bridge the other day, and I once spotted Gary Lineker at the farmer's market. He played football for England, and now works as a sports commentator, just like Jack. Have you ever noticed that TV presenters have big heads? I don't mean they're conceited or up themselves, although some of them probably are. I'm talking very literally. I've seen Jeremy Clarkson, and his head was humongous. It was like a poorly inflated beach ball, all jowly and pale. They don't tell you that in the gossip magazines, about the big heads. And it's not like you can inflate your head on purpose if you want a job on TV. You either have one or you don't. Jack has one, a big head and great hair, and whiter than white teeth. His chin's a little on the weak side, but he keeps it tilted up when he's on camera. Now he's on his second coffee. I like the way he licks his forefinger before he turns the pages of a newspaper. He's good with the kids. He picks up crayons when they drop them and carries their drawings home to show Mummy. I first saw Meg not 100 yards from this very spot. She was in the park with Lucy and Lachlan, who were playing with a bubble wand, chasing after the soapy orbs. Meg wore a simple white shirt and jeans. I pictured her working for a fashion magazine as a photographer or a stylist, which wasn't far from the truth. I thought she'd have a stockbroker husband and a holiday villa in the south of France where they went for long weekends. They invited friends, all of whom were attractive and successful, and they'd eat French cheese and drink French wine, and Meg would complain that baguettes were the work of the devil because they went straight to her hips. I love making up stories like this. I imagine whole lives for people, giving them names and careers, inventing their backstories and populating their families with black sheep and terrible secrets. Maybe it comes from reading so many books as a child. I grew up with Anne of Green Gables, spied with Harriet, wrote plays with Joe March, and explored Narnia with Lucy, Peter, Edmund, and Susan. It didn't matter that I sat alone at lunchtimes and rarely got invited to parties. My fictional friends were just as real, and when I closed a book at night, I knew they would still be there in the morning. I still love reading, but nowadays I search the internet for information about pregnancy and childbirth and looking after babies. That's how I discovered that Meg has her own blog, a site called Mucky Kids, where she writes about motherhood and the funny, weird stuff that happens in her daily life. Like the time Lucy wrote a letter to the Tooth Fairy and argued that £2 was too little for a front tooth, Or when Lachlan broke a full bottle of blue nail polish and created a Smurf murder scene. The blog has photos of Meg, but she doesn't use any real names. Jack is called Hail Caesar, Lachlan is Augustus, and Lucy is Julia. Caesar had a daughter. Meg is Cleopatra, of course. If you read her blog posts, you can tell that she used to be a journalist. She wrote for a women's magazine, and some of her articles are still online, including an interview with Jude Law, who she called Sex on Legs, and admitted to flirting with over oysters and champagne at the Savoy Hotel. Across the road at the cafe, Jack is packing up the kids, strapping Lachlan in a pushchair and holding Lucy's hand. As they cross the park, Lucy has to touch the trunk of every tree, while leaves fall in their wake like confetti at a wedding. I follow from a distance, across the green, past the pond, turning left and right, until we reach Cleveland Gardens, a pretty road lined with Victorian semis and neatly trimmed hedges. During the Blitz, a German bomb flattened three houses at the far end of the road. A block of flats replaced them, which the locals call divorce towers, because so many straying husbands, and the occasional wife, have finished up there in the aftermath of an affair. Some eventually go home, others move on. Directly behind Jack and Meg's house is a railway line, the Hounslow Loop, which gets about four trains an hour during the week and fewer on weekends. The trains aren't so noisy, not like the planes, which line up from first light and sweep overhead a mile apart, descending towards Heathrow. Crossing the road, I cut through Beverly Path until I come to the pedestrian underpass. The wire fence has partially collapsed, making it easy to climb over. Checking the coast is clear, I walk along the railway tracks, stumbling over the broken scree, counting the back gardens. A very angry Alsatian hurls itself at one of the fences as I pass. My heart leaps. I snarl back at him. When I near the right house, I crawl under the undergrowth and climb onto a fallen tree, which is my favourite vantage point. From here, I can look across a narrow garden that runs 50 feet past a Wendy house and a children's swing set, and a rear shed that Jack has turned into a home office, which he never uses. I hear little girls giggling. Lucy has a friend over for a playdate. They're in the Wendy house, pretending to make cups of tea. Lachlan is sitting in the sandpit, moving mini mountains with a bulldozer. The French doors are open, and Meg is in the kitchen, cutting up fruit for a morning snack. Leaning back against a large branch, I take a can of soft drink from a coat pocket and pull the tab, sipping the spillage. I also have a chocolate bar that I'm saving for later. I can sit for hours and watch Meg and Jack and the children. I've watched them having summer barbecues and afternoon tea, or playing games in the garden. One day I saw Meg and Jack lying on a blanket. Meg had her head resting on Jack's thigh while she read a book. She looked like Julia Roberts in that scene in Notting Hill, lying with her head in Hugh Grant's lap. I love that movie. Every 15 minutes, a train rattles past. I turn to see the carriages lit from within, the passengers captivated by mobile phones or newspapers, or leaning their heads against the glass. One or two are looking at me as they pass. Being seen doesn't worry me. I don't look like a burglar or a peeping Tom. When it begins to grow dark, I follow Meg's path through the house as she turns on lights. Children are bathed, teeth are brushed, and bedtime stories are read. Cold and hungry, I don't stay to see Jack arrive home, but I picture him coming through the door, shrugging off his coat, loosening his tie and grabbing Meg around the waist. She shooes him away and pours him a wine, listening to him talk about his day. After they've eaten, they'll pack the dishwasher and curl up together on the sofa, their faces painted with flickering light from the TV. And later, they will lead each other upstairs and make love in their king-sized bed. It's easy to imagine these things, because I've been inside the house. It was before Meg and Jack moved in, when the place was up for sale. House hunting is one of my hobbies, and I arranged a viewing. The estate agent, a bottle blonde with a figure-hugging wardrobe, showed me round, pointing out the important features, calling it characterful and priced to sell. I could see how she operated, flirting with the husbands and charming the wives, but never within earshot of each other. She acted like a co-conspirator, convincing each spouse that she would help sway his or her partner. She tried the same thing with me, asking questions about my husband and whether he'd be coming along. I pretended to be talking to him on the phone. Yes, I think it's big enough, but I'm a little worried about the train noise. You'll hear them in the summer with the windows open. Walking from room to room, I examined the oven and the self-closing drawers and ran my finger over the stainless steel appliances and marble tops. I tested the water pressure and flicked the gas rings on and off. The estate agent took my name and details, not the real ones, of course. I have lots of favourite names. Jessica, or Sienna, or Kira. I didn't realise that Meg and Jack had bought the house until I followed Meg home that first time. Now, I can picture them in every room. Lucy in the back bedroom, Lachlan in the middle one, and the nursery immediately above the stairs. I've left it too late, and it's grown too dark to see the path clearly. Edging forward, I stumble over roots and fallen branches, feeling brambles tug at my clothes and scratch my exposed skin. The railway tracks shine silver in the ambient light, and I move tentatively over the broken rocks and sleepers. The crickets fall silent, and the rails begin to hum. A train coming. Stumbling to one side, I turn to be blinded by a bright light. The engine blasts past me in a roar of noise and rushing air that shakes the ground and sends dead leaves dancing around my legs. I hold my belly, protecting my baby, telling him I'll keep him safe. Megan. Maybe I'm not cut out for motherhood. In the first trimester I worried about miscarriage. Later I fretted about premature labour, birth complications, medical negligence and myriad other disasters. After he's born, I'll be anxious about SIDS, influenza, infections, meningitis, bumps, bruises, rashes and high temperatures. Every cough, sniffle or sneeze will have me on edge. When he learns to walk and run and climb, I will worry about falls, broken bones, open drawers, hot plates and domestic poisons. This will never change, regardless of his age. When he's 18, I'll worry about drunk drivers, drug dealers, bullies, unemployment, student debts, and girls who break his heart. I write about these doubts and insecurities in my blog, and readers think I'm joking. They expect me to be an expert, having practiced on Lucy and Lachlan, but I simply find new mistakes to make and new fears to keep me awake at night. I had a scan today. An ultrasound technician smeared gel over my belly and gave me a running commentary, pointing out all the bits. My little passenger has two arms, two legs, and the requisite number of chambers in his heart, which is beating like the wings of a hummingbird. My doctor says everything is fine, my blood pressure, my urine, my iron levels, etc. I put on 38 pounds, and that's okay too, although I feel clumsy and uncoordinated because I keep bumping into things. My belly is like an airbag. Home again, I'm looking at the unfinished nursery. The curtains must be measured and ordered, and Lachlan's old baby clothes are in boxes in the attic. I started with great plans for a perfect little boy's room, but nothing has turned out like I imagined. The truth is, I don't care as long as he's healthy and happy and treats me nicely. As if reading my mind, he chooses that moment to kick me hard in the kidneys. "Hey, what's that for?" He kicks me again. "Do that again and you're never borrowing the car." I picture him sometimes, my unborn son, as the world's smallest assassin, a fetal torturer who is punishing me for what I did to Jack. Every kick and elbow and headbutt is retribution, and every scan a reminder of my eternal shame. The other memory prompt plays tennis with my husband every week. His name is Simon Kidd, and he and Jack are best friends. They met at Exeter University and were thick as thieves, sharing a house, going to the same parties and playing wingman when they were on the pull, which they reminisce about constantly. Lucy once asked them what they were pulling, and I waggled my little finger at Jack. I've always thought them an odd pair of friends. Simon was the sort of undergraduate who couldn't leave a drug or a girl untried, while Jack was far more studious, dependable, and health-conscious. Although Jack doesn't know it, and never will, I had a brief fling with Simon. It was years before I met Jack. I was working for a magazine, and Simon was trying to get funding for a film project. He invited me to lunch, hoping I'd write a story, and we were in bed within 2 hours. Simon had a house share in Brook Green, which was full of second-hand film equipment and second-rate hangers-on. I broke it off after 4 months because I couldn't handle the sweat-soaked sheets and his itinerant, druggy friends. By then I was well aware of Simon's effect on women, how they clung on his every word or went giggly if he smiled at them. Is he handsome? Yes, but not ruggedly so. He's almost too pretty, with his high cheekbones and piercing grey eyes. I've learnt how to look at him and be unaffected, which is a bit like viewing a partial eclipse of the sun, never straight on or you risk going blind. Even after we stopped seeing each other, I would run into Simon occasionally at film premieres and short film festivals. He was always very flirty and attentive, asking if I was seeing anyone. Later, he moved to America and then Hong Kong. We lost touch. When I met Jack, he sometimes mentioned a friend called Simon, but I didn't put two and two together because they had nicknames for each other. It wasn't until our wedding eve that I realized. Jack had arranged to pick Simon up from Heathrow, and I did a double take when I saw him. Caught by surprise, I made a spur-of-the-moment decision not to say anything to Jack. Simon played along. It seems silly now, but I was getting married the next day, and I knew how jealous and competitive Jack can be. I didn't want to spend my last night being quizzed about old boyfriends and what we did together. Later, in the kitchen of Jack's flat, I whispered to Simon, "You remember me?" "Of course." "I thought maybe you were so..."
"Out of it?"
"Yes."
"I stopped all that. It's strange being lucid all the time. Boring, but I'll live longer."
All of Simon's neurotic energy had gone. He was still snobbish and sarcastic, but more fun to be around. Women remained easy prey, most of them deathly pale model types with cheekbones instead of breasts, who were serious girlfriends until he announced otherwise. After I married Jack, Simon became a regular visitor at our first house and then this one. He and Jack play regular games of tennis or golf at the Roehampton Club in the summer. Jack helped Simon get his job at the network, where he's proved a hit with viewers, having just the right combination of gravitas and cheeky charm. Apart from being Jack's best man, Simon is Lucy's godfather, which he finds hilarious because he's so utterly godless, and he says he can't wait until Lucy turns 18 when he can get her stoned or pissed or both. I know that he's joking, but not completely. My own relationship with him was fine until 8 months ago, and he hasn't been to the house since. Jack keeps inviting him, but Simon makes excuses.
"I can't understand what's happened," Jack told me. "Did you guys have a fight?"
"No."
"Well, he seems to be avoiding you."
I changed the subject and tried not to mention Simon. In truth, I can't think about him without wanting to curl up in a corner and sob. I can't think of him without remembering a night in mid-March, when Jack and I had a blazing row about money, which was merely the trigger. It began when I reversed the car into a lamppost, denting the rear hatch lid. It was my fault. I should have admitted my mistake, but I pushed back when Jack accused me of being careless. We fought. My mother once told me that someone had to be soft in a marriage or it wasn't going to work. Not me, I thought. Not this time. Jack has a similar stubborn streak, charging into every argument, wielding accusations like a bayonet. Wounded, I went low, almost begging him to overreact. He did. He raised his fist. I cringed. He didn't strike, but I saw it in his eyes. So did Jack. I think he frightened himself that day.
"I don't know why I married you," he roared. "If it weren't for the kids, I'd be long gone."
Silently, I packed Lucy and Lachlan into the car and dropped them at my parents' place. My mother wanted to know what had happened. I couldn't talk to her. I drove to Simon's flat, struggling to see the road through splinter tears. I wanted to ask him why Jack was so unhappy. Had he said anything? Was it over? I was a mess. Simon poured me some wine. I talked. He listened. A lot of men fail to realize how attractive that is to a woman, listening. Not interrupting, not judging. He let me sob on his shoulder.
He wiped away my tears with his thumb. He whispered that things would all work out. I was too drunk to drive home. Simon offered to call me a cab. I stood and stumbled. He caught me. Our lips were close. We kissed. I clung to him. We tumbled backwards onto the sofa, kissing again and again, taking off our clothes, kicking off boots and popping buttons. I lifted my hips. He spread my knees. He lowered his head and used his tongue. I shouted, and it didn't sound like me. Afterwards, I drew him inside me, urging him to fuck me harder. I knew it was wrong, but I didn't want him to stop. I wanted to feel something other than anger and disappointment. I wanted to have hot, raw, unadulterated sex and fuck the consequences. Afterwards, we lay on Simon's Pashtun rug, catching our breath. I saw the silhouette of branches thrown by the streetlights against the blinds and recognized a different world from the one that had existed only a few moments ago. The lust and anger had seeped away, leaving behind a terrible numbness and an emptiness that felt violent. Where did it come from? Was I really so unhappy? I retrieved my knickers and pulled them on under my skirt, smoothing my blouse. I was in shock. What had I done? After 6 years of blissful, okay, reasonably happy marriage, out of the clear blue sky, I had shagged my husband's best friend. What was I thinking? Clearly, I wasn't. There are no excuses. I am a terrible person. I'm the sort of crass, shameless slag who should be humiliated by Jeremy Kyle or Dr. Phil. Yes, Jack raised his hand, but he didn't hit me. He said he didn't love me, but he was angry, lashing out. Every relationship goes through rocky patches. We had been through worse and always bounced back. Normally all it takes is a weekend away or a great night out or a moment of intimacy to remind us why we fell in love. In the days that followed, I was convinced that people could see my guilt. I felt it was tattooed on my forehead or sticking out like a forgotten label on a new pair of jeans. Jack apologized for scaring me and agreed to see a marriage counselor. He wasn't particularly open about his feelings at our therapy sessions, but he made an effort, which is more than I did. My secret crippled me. It wasn't simply about the betrayal. It was a shameful memory of how good the sex was, how hot and urgent and desperate. Each time the details flooded back to me, my thighs wanted to open and close. I had to squeeze them together, hating myself even more. Anyone who says that honesty is the best policy is living in la-la land. Either that, or they've never been married or had children. Parents lie to their kids all the time about sex, drugs, death, and 100 other things. We lie to those we love to protect their feelings. We lie because that's what love means, whereas unfettered honesty is cruel and the height of self-indulgence. Then came our weekend away and the madly impulsive hotel sex. I missed my periods in April and May. I panicked. I couldn't remember if Simon had used a condom. I rang him. In the background, I could hear people laughing and drinking in a noisy bar. Simon told me yes.
Why? He asked, shouting.
No reason.
I thought we were never going to speak about that night.
We're not. Ever.
I'll take it to my grave.
Good.
Agatha. We had a robbery at the supermarket today. A jittery-looking dodo in a hoodie and sunglasses was hanging around near the freezer section, muttering and shaking his head. He didn't have a shopping basket, and he kept glancing at the CCTV cameras above the aisles.
"What can't you find?"
I asked, trying to be helpful. He blanked me completely and walked away, heading towards the doors. I was going to say something to Mr. Patel, who was at the registers, but I thought the guy was leaving. At the last moment, he turned back and pulled a knife. Mr. Patel's eyes snapped open like they were spring-loaded. I think I might have screamed. The guy told him,
"Empty the register or I'll cut your throat."
He spun around and waved the knife at me.
"Get on the floor."
I pointed to myself as if to say, "Who, me?" and dropped to my knees.
All the way down, he said, on your stomach.
Really? He noticed I was pregnant and said I could stay on all fours. Mr. Patel was trying to open the register. He kept pressing the no sale button, but the key was on the wrong setting and the cash drawer wouldn't open. The robber told him to hurry up.
You have to buy something, said Mr. Patel. What?
I can't open the drawer unless you buy something. The robber looked at him incredulously.
I don't think you know how this works.
Right, said Mr. Patel, nodding furiously. I was in the process of moving away, crawling back towards the end of the aisle, but I could see Mr. Patel was panicking. I called out, "Scan the cigarettes!" Mr. Patel took his eyes off the knife and looked at me. "The cigarettes! Scan them!" I said. "The register will open." That solved the problem and the drawer opened. Mr. Patel gave him the cash.
"Where's the rest of it?"
"That's all." The knife man pointed to the drawer below the register. It's where Mr. Patel keeps the daily cash float and any large bills. It's also where he has a loaded gun, which he shows to all the new employees, particularly the college girls who work weekends and he hopes might be impressed. Great plan, I thought. He'll make a citizen's arrest or shoot the guy if necessary. But Mr. Patel didn't go for the gun. He handed over the cash float and said to the knife man,
"Can I get you anything else?"
"Why not join our loyalty program? How about some scratch lotto tickets?" Later, Mr. Patel told the police he was trying to protect me, which was bollocks because I saved his arse. We both had to give statements and look at mugshots on a computer, but I'm terrible at remembering faces. The knife I could have picked out of any lineup. The police wanted to have a doctor examine me because of my pregnancy, but I told them I was fine and just wanted to go home. They gave me a taxi voucher and said I should take tomorrow off work, which didn't impress Mr. Patel. The cab drops me outside my flat, and I step over junk mail as I shoulder open the large front door. I'm tired now that the adrenaline has evaporated, and the stairs seem steeper than before. My flat is on the first floor. Mrs. Brindle, my landlady, lives downstairs with her two sons, Gary and Dave, who are both 40-something and in no hurry to leave home. Gary, the older one, is on a disability pension, while Dave drives a minicab. I suspect half the reason Mrs. Brindle charges me so little rent is because she's hoping I might take one of them off her hands. A door opens behind me.
"Hello, Princess."
"Go away, Dave."
"Need a hand?"
"No." He positions himself at the bottom of the stairs so he can look up my dress. I move closer to the wall.
"Don't be like that," he says. "You have great legs, Agatha. What time do they open?"
"Drop dead." I keep climbing. He shouts after me.
"Just remember, I've got a condom with your name on it."
"What? Durex extra small?"
"That's a good one," he laughs. "But I'll be gentle with you."
Flopping onto the sofa, I kick off my shoes and rub my feet, which ache from standing up all day. The buttons on my blouse are stretched so tightly across my belly they could pop and take out an eye. I loosen them and glance at the mess around me, wishing I'd cleaned up last night or yesterday. Unwashed dishes are piled up in the sink, and the dining table is covered in brochures and catalogues for baby clothes. Further along the hallway is a bathroom with a tub and my bedroom, which is really nice because I can make it dark and sleep until noon when I don't have work. My double bed is a rickety affair with a varnished headboard and a boggy, soft mattress. At night, I like turning off the lights and listening to trains pulling into Putney Bridge Station. My best friend Jules lives upstairs with her husband Kevin and their little boy Leo, who is 4 and a real cutie. I sometimes babysit Leo when Jules nips out to the shops, or the laundrette, or to get her hair done. Jules is pregnant again, and we've been inseparable these past months, shopping and having manicures and treating ourselves to chocolate milkshakes, which are the best cure for morning sickness ever invented. Having caught my breath, I retrieve 3 envelopes from the doormat, a gas bill, a telephone bill, and a letter from my mother. I recognize her handwriting and the Spanish stamps. What does she want? I should throw it away.
Something makes me tear at the flap and unfold the single perfumed page. Dear Agatha, please don't be angry with me for writing to you again. I'm not even sure I have the right address. I tried to call, but you must have changed your number. I miss you. I've been dreadfully lonely, and you're the last family I have left. I know a lot has happened between us, but I'm hoping that you can forgive me. Marbella is sunny, but not as warm as it was last year. I'm renting the same apartment, which is next door to Mr. and Mrs. Hopgood. I mentioned them in my past letters. He's a bit of a bore, but Maggie's nice. We play bingo together and have cocktails at the yacht club. You should come and visit. I could send you money for the airfare. We could spend Christmas together. They do a lovely spread at the yacht club, with roast turkey and a free bottle of wine on every table. Please write back to me. With all my love, Mum. Kiss, kiss. Hug, hug. I tear the letter into little pieces and put them in the kitchen bin, which is so full of rubbish that the scraps fall on the floor. My mother doesn't know I'm pregnant. She'd only mess things up. Someone knocks on the door. "Piss off, Dave!" I shout. "It's me," answers Jules. "Shit." "Okay, give me a minute." I straighten my clothes and button my blouse, checking myself in the mirror before unlocking the door. "What took you so long?" asks Jules. She waddles past me and throws herself onto the sofa with a grunt. "You left me waiting out there forever." Half German and half Scottish, with an explosion of wire wool hair and legs like tree stumps, Jules is a striking-looking woman, and I envy her clear skin and doe-brown eyes. Big, even before she got pregnant. She loves to flaunt her size because Kevin likes her that way. He's not a feeder or a fatty lover, but he definitely plumps for the plump. I tell her about the robbery, and she hangs on every word, wanting to know if I was frightened. "He was probably an ice addict," she says. "Those guys are mega scary. They eat people's faces." "Really?" She nods. "That stuff causes holes in your brain and makes your teeth fall out." "This robber had all his teeth. For now." Suddenly she remembers why she's come downstairs. "He, do you want to come with me to an acupuncturist? I got a 2-for-1 offer." "Nobody is sticking needles in my baby," I say. "They don't stick needles in the baby," she replies, waving a brochure. "This says acupuncture helps pregnant women get over nausea, fluid retention, tiredness, cramps, and heartburn." "Even so, what about a bikini wax? I'm not bothering at the moment." "Lucky for some," she sniffs. "I got a full 70s triangle growing down there. Kevin needs a machete to find my grotto." "You're disgusting." "At least I'm getting some," says Jules. "Upon which subject, have you heard from Sailor Boy?" "I haven't checked." My laptop is hidden under magazines. I open it up and wait for the wireless to find a signal. 2 emails pop into my inbox. One of them is spam. The other is from Hayden. My heart trembles. "He's going to call me tonight," I whisper, blinking at her in shock. "What else does it say?" she asks excitedly. "That's all." Megan. Lucy has a friend over this afternoon. Her name is Madeline, and she's a grumpy little madam who ignores my fruit platter and asks for chocolate biscuits and crisps. I tell her, "We don't have those in our house," and Madeline looks at me as though I'm something nasty on her shoe. They're playing outside now. I think Lachlan is getting a cold, so I give him a bath and some paracetamol and let him watch the Disney Channel. I glance at the clock. Madeline is getting picked up at 6. I want to fast forward and have everyone in bed so I can crawl beneath the covers and sleep. Jack is away tonight. He's been in a good mood all week. I'd say back to normal, but I don't know what normal is anymore. No, that's not true. I love it when Jack teases me and flirts and randomly touches me, brushing my backside or cupping my waist or stealing a quick snog when we pass on the stairs. Lachlan is laughing at something,
I sit next to him on the sofa and put my arm around him, sniffing his fresh-out-of-the-bath little boy smell.
Is Daddy coming home?
Not until tomorrow.
Where is he?
Working.
Is he going to be on TV?
Uh-huh. Later I make Lachlan a boiled egg for dinner and line up toast soldiers on either side of his egg cup. He's a hungry child in all senses, desperate to grow up, a wrecker of games, a hoarder of toys, and a monopolizer of attention. Lucy appears tolerant, but recently I've noticed scratches on Lachlan's arms. His favorite truck disappeared a week ago, triggering howls of outrage. Lucy watched from the corner, denying all knowledge. I found the truck beneath her bed a few days later. Lucy and Madeline have macaroni cheese, which Lucy normally loves, but today she turns up her nose, mimicking Madeline. Why do children choose the most inappropriate friends? I'll probably write about this tonight, changing the names, of course. My blog is like a hungry beast that has to be fed with more and more content. At university, I dreamed of being a serious journalist. The next Marie Colvin or Kate Adey, reporting from the rubble-strewn streets of Baghdad or teeming refugee camps in North Africa. I don't know when that ambition died. In truth, I have always been someone who matched expectations rather than exceeded them. When I began writing my blog, I wanted to make it edgy and funny, maybe even controversial. I thought with my background in marketing and public relations, I could influence opinions and build a brand. But in reality, I spend my time writing quirky stories about my imperfect family and oh-so-happy marriage. I read the other day that the average mummy blogger is 37, has two children, is left-leaning, socially conscious, and buys eco-friendly products. That's me. I am a cliché. My blog sums up my existence, safe, uncontentious, and shallow. I clean up the kitchen and the bathroom before making my own dinner, leftovers from the children. Jack calls me from Old Trafford where Manchester United are playing Tottenham at home. It's one of the games of the round, he says, sounding excited. I think the new talk show is in the bag. Don't say that, you could jinx it. He laughs and needs a favour. He left a business card in his other jacket. Can I find it for him? I carry the phone upstairs and go through his wardrobe. Jack spends more money on clothes than I do. He has 3 Paul Smith suits and 2 dozen shirts. Searching through the pockets, I come across a folded sheet of paper. It's a mobile phone number, written in longhand, but someone has placed a lipstick kiss next to the number. No name. I keep searching the pockets until I find a business card. Is this the one you wanted? I ask, reciting the number to Jack. Thanks, babe. I found another number. It's on a piece of paper. The one with a lipstick kiss? No name? Oh, that, he says, not missing a beat. Some woman put that in my pocket in the pub. She recognized me. I think she thought I was a famous footballer. And you kept her number? I didn't keep her number. I forgot it was even there. Are you jealous? No. He starts teasing me. You should be. She was all of 25. Dirty old man. She wanted a job in TV. Don't they all? He laughs and sends hugs and kisses before hanging up. I look at the slip of paper, screw it up, and toss it into the bin. I don't mind that Jack treats me like a girlfriend sometimes, because that can be exciting. We used to have date nights where we each pretended to be someone else. He'd be a pilot and I'd be a weather girl, and we'd meet in a bar where one of us would take the lead and chat the other one up. Once I pretended to be a crazed fan.
Oh my God, you're Jack Shaughnessy, aren't you?
Yeah, he'd reply.
You're on TV, I love your voice. Say something sexy.
Like what?
That's it. Oh, I could just melt. Jack Shaughnessy, blimey, what are you doing here?
We chatted for about 20 minutes and left arm in arm, a textbook pull. The bar staff was stunned. I used to love our date nights and how Jack would write me lovely notes, leaving them in random places such as a microwave or a coat pocket or tucked into my Wellingtons. Dearest wife,
"Your boobs are the best," he'd write, or, "This coupon is good for one extra special foot massage." Yes, he had an ulterior motive, but he didn't have to be so thoughtful. Memories like this make me feel grateful as well as angry. How dare I doubt Jack? I'm the one who broke our vow. Agatha. The satellite image is fuzzy and breaking up, but Hayden's voice comes through clearly. He's dressed in blue overalls, sitting in a small room with charts and maps on the wall. Is that a beard? Ugh! "Can you see me?" I ask, hoping he might comment on my new dress, or the effort I've made on my makeup.
"Yeah," he replies, not bothering to look at the screen. "What's this about you being pregnant?"
"Isn't it wonderful?"
"How did it happen?"
"You must know that, silly."
"I mean, when did you find out?"
"I knew I was late, but my periods are generally all over the shop. Then I went and peed on the stick. Want to see it? I kept it." I wave the stick in front of the screen. The pink line means I'm pregnant.
"How pregnant?"
"I'm due in early December."
"Is it mine?"
"What?"
"The baby. Is it mine?"
"Of course it is. I love you."
"I've been at sea for 7 months.
"I'm 8 months pregnant. It happened when you were here in London. We were going at it like rabbits."
"You said you were on the pill."
"I also asked you to use a condom because I'd missed a few days. You said you didn't like them."
"Why didn't you tell me sooner?"
"I tried, but you wouldn't answer my messages. I sent emails and letters. I posted Facebook messages. You didn't answer."
"You said nothing about a baby."
"I wasn't going to just blurt it out. It's a private thing. I've had the ultrasound pictures. Do you want to see them?" Hayden takes a deep breath and sighs, staring at the ceiling as though looking for a celestial sign or hoping for heavenly intervention.
"What do you want me to do?" he asks.
"I'm not expecting you to marry me or anything daft like that."
"Why tell me at all?"
"I thought you should know. If you don't want anything to do with me, I'll accept that. But this is your baby as much as mine." He looks at the screen and shakes his head.
"I don't want a baby."
"Well, it's a bit late for that now." I stand up and turn sideways, running my hands over my tummy. "This is really happening." He looks away again. "I know you think I'm springing this on you," I say. "But I did try to tell you. I wrote almost every day, but you were angry with me and wanted a break."
"We weren't on a break. We broke up."
"I did a foolish thing going through your emails. But don't you see? I must have been pregnant when I did that. My hormones were all over the place."
"And that's your excuse?"
"It's the truth." Hayden pushes away from the screen. "Christ to hell, I can't deal with this. We can talk when you get home."
"No, I want you to stay away from me."
"What about the baby?"
"You want it, you have it."
"Please, Hayden, don't be cruel."
"I didn't sign up for this. You should have got rid of it."
"What?"
"Had an abortion."
"No!"
"Don't contact me again. Understand?"
The screen goes blank. I tap the keyboard but can't bring him back. Refusing to cry, I tell myself that Hayden can change his mind. Right now, he thinks I'm a battalion bike or base bunny who hangs around Navy barracks hoping to snare a man in uniform. He's wrong. I love him. I'm going to show him what a great mother I can be. And before long, he'll be down on one knee, begging to marry me. And 30 years from now, we'll laugh about this and be talking about our grandkids. Jules knocks. She's probably been waiting outside, busting to know what Hayden said. I let her in. She looks at me, hopefully, ready to commiserate. "So, what happened? Was he excited?" "Over the moon. I told you he would be." She laughs and dances around the room, shaking her curves. "He asked me to marry him," I say. "Get away." "Yeah? Why didn't he answer your messages?" "He said he was scared of falling in love with me." "That's so sweet. So what did you tell him?" "I said I'd have to think about it." "You're a daft cow. Why didn't you say yes?"
He made me wait. Now I'll make him wait. Jules wants to hear all the details, what I said, what he said. I have to make up the conversation, but she doesn't question any of my explanations.
Where is Hedon now?
They're sailing to Cape Town.
Maybe he'll buy you an engagement ring in South Africa.
They have the best diamonds.
I don't want a diamond ring.
Yes, you do. All girls love diamonds.
Is he coming home for the birth?
No.
But he should be with you.
That's okay. I'm going to have the baby in Leeds.
You hate your mother.
I shrug. We've had her ups and downs, but I need a birth partner and she's offering.
Shame I can't do it, says Jules.
But I have one small problem. She points to her bump. I give her a hug. I could always borrow Kevin.
He's useless, believe me.
When will you go up north? Closer to the time. Jules knows all about my family. Not the whole story, but enough for her to understand my love-hate relationship with my mother. She says I should reach out and build bridges, but I think certain bridges are meant to burn, and it's a shame some people can't be on them when it happens.
Megan. The house is quiet. The kids are asleep. I've spent the past hour doing the ironing in front of the TV, producing a pile of neatly folded linen and a collection of sweet-smelling shirts hanging from the doorknob. I like the regimen and skill involved with ironing, which makes me feel in some small, domestic way that I'm keeping the chaos at bay. Occasionally I glance up the stairs and listen for a cry or a summons. Lucy sleeps with the light on. She doesn't have nightmares or fear the dark, but she likes to know where she is in the world when she wakes at night. Jack still isn't home. He normally calls if he's running late. I've tried his mobile, and his office said he left hours ago. The new show has been preying on his mind. They have a name, Shoot, but he still hasn't heard who's going to be the host. Other presenters are being auditioned. Not just anyone. Simon Kidd, the man I slept with, the one I'm desperately trying to forget. Jack and Simon have always been competitive, but that hardly matters when they're on a tennis court or golf course or playing Trivial Pursuit. This is important. If Simon were to get the nod, I don't know how Jack would react. I try his mobile again. It goes straight to messages. I leave another one.
Jack, it's me. Where are you? I'm worried. Please call.
I'm in bed when he arrives home. I hear the car keys hitting the side table and his shoes being kicked off. The fridge door opens. He's getting himself a beer. A part of me wants to turn off the light and pretend to be asleep. Instead, I go downstairs. He's in the garden, sitting on Lucy's swing, nursing a beer. I take the swing next to him, rocking back and forth in my slippers.
Did you drive home?
No. He's loosened his tie and half pulled out his shirt. I didn't get the job.
Did they give it to Simon?
No.
Who?
Becky Kellerman. She works on one of the lifestyle channels.
Does she know anything about sport?
She looks good on camera.
That's so unfair.
His forehead creases. The whole show was my bloody idea. I came up with the concept, the name. I even came up with the promo line, straight from the lip.
At least it wasn't Simon, I say.
Why'd you say that?
I know how competitive you two are.
What makes you think we're competitive?
Nothing. Forget I said anything.
We sit in silence for a while. I want to ask him what he's thinking, but I'm afraid of what he might say. There was a time when we talked a lot, sharing our thoughts, but now Jack communicates more by his silences.
I wish I could do something to help, I say, reaching out and taking his hand.
And I know it's no consolation, but I think you're brilliant, and they're mad not to give you the hosting job. Jack turns over my hand and kisses the palm. Do you ever worry about things?
Like what?
Money.
We're not poor.
We're going to need a bigger car and another bedroom.
This house is big enough.
What if three children are too many? What if we have no time for each other?
This one catches me by surprise, and my tongue suddenly feels too thick for my mouth.
I don't want to lose you ever, he whispers.
So don't go anywhere, I reply softly,
hoping it sounds convincing. He gives me a reproachful look.
I envy you.
Why?
You can make the best of any situation. You don't get depressed. You don't have doubts.
Everybody has doubts.
And you have this weird kind of honesty. You don't hide things. You show everybody exactly who you are, and they love you back.
I hear the catch in my voice as I change the subject.
Are you hungry?
Jack shakes his head. I stand and pull my dressing gown tighter around me.
I'm going to bed. Are you coming?
Not yet.
Don't stay up too late.
Sliding under the duvet, I close my eyes but cannot sleep. Lying awake, I try to understand Jack's sadness. I know he's crazy about Lucy and Lachlan, and I still think he's crazy about me, but we approach life differently. Jack anticipates problems in advance and prepares for the worst, marshalling the resources to handle things. I take problems as they come, bending rather than breaking. If Jack reacts like this to losing a job opportunity, how would he handle knowing that I slept with Simon? He can never know. Never.
Agatha. Hayden's parents live in Colindale, North London, in one of those post-war cottages with a pebble-dashed facade and a small front garden. Two stories, bay window, neat flowerbeds. The roses are blooming late. Mr. and Mrs. Cole know that I'm coming. I phoned ahead and Mr. Cole offered to pick me up from the station, but I said I could walk. I'm wearing one of my nicest dresses, a cute A-line from Mothercare with cap sleeves and a round neckline. It's a little short and flouncy for meeting the parents, but I want them to see me as a future daughter-in-law, not someone auditioning for Amish life. I find the house, ring the bell. The door opens instantly. Mrs. Cole is beaming at me. She looks like a 50s austerity bride who sews and bakes and organizes street parties on royal occasions. Her husband is in the hallway behind her, his bald dome shining under a miniature chandelier. I didn't picture Hayden losing his hair, which is a little worrying. Mr. Cole works for the Royal Mail and has some fancy-sounding title, but I think he sorts parcels or stamps letters. Hayden's mum is a teacher at a deaf school and can do sign language. That's because Hayden's younger brother is deaf. He might also be dumb, although I don't think people use that term anymore. Hayden's older sister is married and living in Norfolk. I can't remember if she has kids. After the introductions, I'm shown into the room they call the parlour, where I perch on the edge of the sofa, knees together. Everything in this room seems to match, with the same floral pattern on the curtains, the cushions and the waste paper basket. Tea and cake are served. I'm starving, but I'm on crumb watch.
Are you sure you won't have a piece? Asks Mrs. Cole.
No, thank you. They've both noticed that I'm pregnant, but I haven't referenced the fact. Instead, we talk about the weather and the train journey and how much we like lemon cake. I don't know if Hayden has told you much about me, I say, when the conversation begins to falter.
Very little, replies Mrs. Cole, glancing at her husband. Well, he and I began a relationship when he was on shore leave in January.
You might have wondered why he didn't come home on many of those nights. He was staying at my place. They are still perched forward on their armchairs, not reacting. What do I have to do? Draw them a diagram? I take a tissue from my coat pocket and blow my nose.
This is very difficult, I say. Normally I wouldn't have bothered you, but Hayden has given me little choice. He won't answer my emails. I talked to him a week ago and he...
I can't get the words out. Mrs. Cole puts a hand on my knee.
Are you having Hayden's baby?
I nod and cry even harder. There is a beat of silence. Mr. Cole looks like he would rather be having a prostate exam than be sitting in the parlour talking to me. I'm crying softly. I apologise and smear mascara across my cheeks. Mrs. Cole sits next to me on the sofa and puts her arm around my shoulders.
What did Hayden say?
He said he wants nothing to do with me or the baby. He said I should have an abortion, but it's too late, and it's against my religion. I have no one else to turn to. My real mum is dead.
Dead?
To me, I blurt, catching my mistake.
She's dead to me. We rarely speak.
You poor thing, says Mrs. Cole. More tissues, Gerald. He jumps to attention and turns in a complete circle before heading into the kitchen. Once the tissues are found, I blow my nose again and wipe my eyes. Mrs. Cole has been asking the obvious questions about when the baby is due and whether I've visited a doctor. I show her the ultrasound pictures.
Oh, look, Gerald. You can see everything. Fingers, toes. He's very healthy, I say. Are you having a boy?
Yes. Within 20 minutes, we're talking like a mother and daughter-in-law, discussing hospitals, morning sickness and pain relief. Soon, she's bringing out the family photo albums and showing me pictures of Hayden as a baby.
He was a big lump. 9 pounds, she says. I needed stitches.
I flinch and she pats my knee.
Don't you worry. You look like you're built to have babies. I was a mere slip of a thing, wasn't I, Gerald?
Mr. Cole doesn't answer. She asks where I'm living and how I'm coping. I tell her about Jules and my lovely mother's group that meets every Friday morning for coffee opposite Barnes Green. Soon, I'm looking at photographs of Hayden as a toddler and starting school, and as a spotty teenager. I get the guided tour of his bedroom and a recap on how he won each of his sporting trophies. It grows dark. Mrs. Cole insists I stay for dinner, sitting me at the head of the table. Clearly, this is a big deal, their first grandchild. Hayden's sister hasn't been blessed, says Mrs. Cole, who gives me extra helpings of everything. The deaf son, Regan, has been hiding in his bedroom all afternoon. He stares at me through dinner, signing questions to his mother, who signs back. I get the impression they're discussing me, which is unnerving. I've heard that people who lose a particular sense, like their sight or hearing, sometimes develop heightened abilities in other areas. What if Regan can read my mind? The plates are cleared away, and we return to the parlour, where Mr. Cole lights the gas fire and sits next to me on the sofa. I think he's warming to me, or it could be the third sherry I saw him pour in when Mrs. Cole wasn't watching.
Where are you planning to have the baby? He asks.
My mother lives in Leeds.
You said she was dead to you?
Yes, but I'm going to make things right. Today, coming here, has been a big step for me, and you've been so nice and welcoming that I know I can patch things up with my mum.
So you'll go up north?
Uh-huh. I did hope that Hayden would be with me. I leave the statement hanging. Mr. Cole pats me on the knee.
You did the right thing, coming to see us. Don't you worry about our Hayden. I'll see he does right by you.
I wipe away another tear. They come so easily. I hate the idea that he thinks I'm having this baby to make him stay, or to make him love me. It's not like I'm asking him to marry me. I take Mr. Cole's hand and hold it against my belly. Can you feel that? He nods uncertainly.
Does he move a lot?
All the time. Mrs. Cole joins us with more tea and lemon cake.
Hayden still has some growing up to do, she says, cutting me a slice. But he's a good boy. I'm sure that once I've had a quiet word with him, he'll be far more understanding. In the meantime, is there anything you need, Agatha?
I shake my head tentatively.
Are you sure?
Well, I've been quite sick, and I've missed a lot of shifts at work. My rent is due, and
how much do you owe?
You don't have to, really.
How much?
A few hundred.
Is that enough?
If I had 500, I could cover all my bills, the electricity and the gas.
I'm sure we can find it, says Mr. Cole. And don't you worry about our Hayden. We'll set him straight.
Hayden calls me that night. I expect him to be angry with me for going behind his back, but he is sweet as can be. I act a little hurt and don't accept his apology.